Okay, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. Okay, it's nice to be back at PI. So this is a joint work with Alexei Ilin and Leonid Rybnikov, and mostly I'm going to be talking about the construction of certain moduli spaces. But I'm going to begin with the motivation for why we started looking at these moduli spaces. And the motivation comes from these certain kinds of algebras called inhomogeneous Gödel algebras. So let me explain where they come from. Okay, so suppose you have G, a semisimple Lie algebra. And suppose you have, say, some representations of G, maybe a tensor product of n representations. And let's imagine they're, say, irreducible representations, and you'd like to break this tensor product into irreducible representations. So one way to do that is as follows. So this Lie algebra, I'm sorry, this tensor product is an action of n copies of the universal enveloping algebra of G, of course. And within here, you can look at the sub-algebra which commutes with the diagonal G action. So this is the diagonally embedded G. So if you, this thing, big guy on the right here, this will commute with G. So this thing will act on the tensor product multiplicity spaces in here. So one way to study these tensor product multiplicity spaces could be to look for a commutative subalgebra of this big algebra on the right-hand side. Okay, so there's a classical way to produce elements in this right-hand side as follows. So the way we do it is, so we say we have n complex numbers, distinct complex numbers. And then we define the Gödel Hamiltonians. As follows. So hi of z, so there can be n of these Hamiltonians. I runs from 1 up to n. And they're defined as follows. Sum over j not equal to I. They're all linear combinations of Casimir elements. So we take a Casimir element omega. So omega here is in G tensor G, Casimir element. And this superscript ij indicates that we insert this Casimir in the ij tensor factors. Then we take a linear combination where we divide by this zi minus zj. These guys. So this is an element in UG tensor N. So these guys are basically the right-hand sides of the Kuznick-Zamolodnikov connection. Okay, so these hi of z commute among themselves. And with the diagonal g. And so they generate a commutative subalgebra of UG tensor N, commuting with diagonal G. Now, for SL2, this is a maximal commutative subalgebra, and for SL2, this is like classical work. You can use this to decompose your tensor product into your EPS. But outside of SL2, you need a bigger subalgebra. And so a larger algebra containing these Gödel Hamiltonians, so for the same kind of parameter, so Z is such an N tuple, an element of Cn mod the diagonal, so n distinct complex numbers. I think the definition is due to Fagan and Frenkel. They defined an algebra depending on these parameters. I'll just write Z for this sequence. So this will be a maximal commutative of UG tensor N commuting with the diagonal G action and it containing those Gödel Hamiltonians. And the next phase of the story is as follows. So this gives you a family of commutative subalgebras here. And you can ask, what happens to this family of subalgebras when you allow these z's to start to coincide? That if you take such a subalgebra and you take its limit, you'll get another maximal commutative subalgebra. But how does that limit depend on how these z's coincide? So we have the following theorem, essentially due to Aguirre, Felder, Veselov, also with earlier work of Shuvalov, and finally followed up by Rybnikov, is the following. So the map, so this is a map from Cn minus delta to subalgebras, maximal commutative subalgebras, which is subalgebras of UG tensor N commuting its G action, descends and extends to as follows. So first, it's easy to see that if you simultaneously scale or simultaneously translate the parameters, that those Godin Hamiltonians don't change. Well, if you simultaneously scale, then they just change up to a scalar. And this algebra is unaffected by that. So this map, like this, factors through a map like so. And this space we can think of as being P1 to the n plus 1 minus delta mod the action of PGL2. So I can use this action of PGL2 to move one of these points to infinity, and then I have a leftover C cross C action. And the theorem is that this map like so extends to a map, even an injective map, from this space. Oh, sorry, not from this space. This space has a natural compactification called M n plus 1 bar. This is the Deligne-Mumford. I'll describe that space in a second. And this thing extends to a map from this Deligne-Mumford space. That's the thing.
Can I ask a question too?
Yeah.
So I thought that there was also like a higher Godin Hamiltonians.
Exactly. So in the this algebra A of Z is generated by those ordinary Godin Hamiltonians and these higher Godin Hamiltonians that I didn't tell you about.
Oh, okay.
It contains these things plus the higher Godin Hamiltonians.
It's just a little funny to me to think of them as points in C to the N. Okay, sorry. I was confused for a second.
So the construction of these higher Godin Hamiltonians or the construction of this full Godin algebra use at the center of at the critical level. Okay. So this Deligne-Mumford space, what is it? So it's one of these moduli space of curves. So it looks as follows. So originally we had like n distinct points in the complex numbers, which I then compactified to n plus 1 distinct points, or didn't compactify, but thought of as n plus 1 distinct points on P1. So here's n plus 1 distinct points on P1. And this is going to be compactified to this space here. And the way it's compactified is that when some marked points become close to each other, they go off onto their own component. So points in this modular space parameterizes curves as follows. Look like so. I call them cactus curves. So they're allowed to have a tree of components, each of which is a P1, and there's some marked points on each P1. And on each P1, there's at least three marked or double points. Okay, so this is an element of this moduli space. Now, also, if if Z is in this moduli space, but now I'm going to actually restrict my attention to the real locus of the moduli space. Okay, so the real locus means that all those the curve is defined over R, and those marked points are real points. So I just have a circle of It actually looks like that. They're all RP1s, circles. Okay. So if Z is in the real locus of the moduli space, then this algebra A of Z X is generated by Hermitian operators with respect to a natural Hermitian form on such a tensor product. And X with simple spectrum on tensor product multiplicity spaces. So I take the number of, I take the copies of V, some other irreducible V0 inside a tensor product V1 up to Vn. Maybe better to call it Vn plus 1. So on such a tensor product multiplicity space, this A of Z acts diagonally with simple spectrum. And therefore, it's interesting to consider the monodromy of these eigen lines for its action. Monodromy of the eigen lines. And so this gives an action. This monodromy is an action of the fundamental group of this space. Fundamental group of the space. And this fundamental group of the space is a very nice group, which I call the cactus group. To be slightly more precise, the cactus group is the equivariant fundamental group.
Can I interrupt one more time? The spectrum is given by, is it given by some solutions, some beta Ansatz equations?
It can be, yeah.
Okay, and there's some duality with rated overs for alignment zero loops.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So you can think of these spectrum as being opers, opers on P1 with prescribed residues at the points related to the highest weights of those representations. Okay. So anyway, we did this board. So this was our joint work with previous joint work with Eva Alacheva and Daniel Rybnikov and Alex Weeks. So we studied this cactus group action on the monodromy of the diagonal lines, and we proved it was given by a combinatorially using the certain cactus group action on crystals. Okay, so in the course of our work, though, we were somehow led to a larger family of algebras called inhomogeneous Godin algebras. Maybe not larger isn't quite the right word, but a different family of algebras. Family. So how does this work? We pick an additional piece of data, which is going to be fixed. So some fixed element in the Cartan, in the regular part of the Cartan. And then these Godin Hamiltonians are going to be modified as follows. Put a chi here. So rather than, they'll be the, did I get the formula correct? Yeah. They'll be the, well, they're not so different. They'll be just the exact same term that there was before. The same thing there was before, but then an additional term, which is just given by the action of this chi inserted in the ith piece in the tensor product. Okay? So this chi I is just chi inserted in the ith tensor factor. And then there's an algebra called the inhomogeneous Godin algebra. So this inhomogeneous Godin algebra. And it was defined by Rybnikov. And also independently by Dagan, Frankel, Toledano, Laredo. And it contains Again, it's not the only generators, but this is just some of the generators to give you an idea. It contains these inhomogeneous Gordan Hamiltonians and the diagonal Cartan subalgebra. So because of the presence of this term, it no longer commutes with the diagonal G action, only with the diagonal Cartan. And so you throw the diagonal Cartan in as well. So rather than here, where it acted on these tensor product multiplicity spaces, this thing will just act on the weight spaces for the tensor product. So this guy acts on. Okay, so we are interested in, so the question that I'm going to talk about today is, what is the compactified parameter space for these algebras? So to be a bit more precise, so this construction, this algebra, so chi is fixed, so you don't need to worry about it, so just the other points are varying. It gives you a map from Cn minus delta, and it's easy to see that it doesn't depend up to simultaneous translation of Zi's, but now scaling of the Zi's does change because it would scale the chi, so we don't scale the Zi's, so just up to simultaneous translation. So endpoints on C, distinct points on C mod C, we have such a map to the space subalgebras of UG tensor N. And this this map turns out to be injective and extends to some compactification, an injective map. So basically the closure of the image of this in here. So what's this question mark? That's the question I'm answering today. So it's going to be some compactification of Cn mod Cn minus delta mod C. Okay. That was all the motivation. And now we'll get to the construction of this question mark is the main goal of the talk. Any questions about that? The motivation.
Is it actually obvious that there have to be, that the closure of that has to be compact because it's an infinite dimensional vector space?
Yes, it's not totally obvious. Yeah. So you can look at the finite filtered pieces, and you can take its closure inside any finite filtered piece, but it's not obvious that it stabilizes. So it's a separate fact of that compact. So it has a compactification sort of in its intersection with any finite filtered piece, and then the fact is that stabilizes. Maybe the fact is an algebra makes finitely generated algebra means that it automatically will stabilize eventually. Okay. So to answer this, I'm going to introduce first one compactification and then another some space, which won't be the right answer, but it's going to get us part of the way there. Okay, so the following general construction, which I think is very cute, so I'll tell you about. Suppose V is a vector space with a map to Cn. Oh, sorry. Yeah, injective map to Cn. So just a subspace of Cn. But I think of this as being sort of like n different linear functionals on V, which you can think of as being like a hyperplane arrangement in V. So given this data, there's a space called the Matroid-Schubert variety. Was defined by Ardila and Bucher. And it's defined as follows. This is the, by definition, it's the closure of V inside P1 to the N. So I have these bunch of maps, and each of those copies of C, I'm going to compactify to P1, and then I take the closure of V. So for example, suppose we take extremely simple V, like the solutions of A plus B equals C inside of C3, okay? So it's pretty simple. So what's V bar? Well, it's a bit not obvious. First of all, so one way to think, say what it is, it's just the solutions of A plus B equals C, but where A and B and C are in P1. Of course, one has to be a little bit precise about what you mean by that, but if you think about it carefully, there's only really one possibility. And when you think about it, there's, what does this V look like? Well, it could, the V bar is V, and then it adds the locus where you have infinity plus b equals infinity, another locus where you have a plus infinity equals infinity, another locus where you have infinity plus infinity equals c. Surprisingly, this may be the least obvious locus, but if you think about it, there is such a possibility. And lastly, you can have infinity plus infinity equals infinity. So you had your original space, and you add on these three. So each of these is a copy of C, these three lines, and this point. And that way, it's not hard to figure out exactly what you add to any V of this form. It depends on this like matroid defined by this hyperplane arrangement. That's why this thing is called matroid Schubert variety. So for example, in this case, one way to picture the space is as follows, at least the real points of the space. So real locus of the space can be pictured as follows. We had our original V, which we picture as like the interior of a hexagon. These three lines are going to be these parts of the hexagon here. So corresponds to like, say this A infinity infinity. So this would be like, when you go this way, you're keeping your A fixed, and B and C are getting bigger. You reach this part, similarly here and here. But this way is sort of like where this is like B and C getting large, and it's like B and C getting very negative. But it's, well, because it's P1, it's the same thing. So this is glued to here. Similarly, this is glued to here. And this is glued to here. So you have a hexagon where all the three pairs of opposite sides are identified. That's a torus. But you're not quite done, because this point here, which is this infinity, infinity, infinity point, is the same as every other point on the outside of the hexagon. And if you just glued those opposite sides together, you'd have two vertices. So then you have to glue these two vertices together. So this is a torus with two points identified. Okay. So that's that example. And now we're going to do this kind of construction, but for our Cn minus delta here, basically. What do I mean by that? Or maybe for this Cn mod C is what I really mean. So let's apply this construction as follows. So I take Cn mod C, and I embed this vector space Cn mod C, Cn mod all ones vector, I embed it in C to the n choose 2 by mapping z1, zn to all possible differences, zi minus zj. This is a special case of something you can do with any Cartan subalgebra. You embed the Cartan subalgebra in C to the positive roots by using the positive roots. That's what I'm doing here. This is like thinking of this as a Cartan of SLN or PGLN. And then because I now have an embedding inside this big vector space, I can take the closure and I call that thing yn. So yn is that closure in that sense using this embedding. So another way of saying it, it's a set of all tau ij's that live in p1 to the n choose 2. And they satisfy the equation. Well, the equation satisfied here is like just simply tau ij plus tau jk equals tau ik. So you can think of this, if this original space here was like n points possibly equal on the line up to translation, here you still have like n points in the line, and you're remembering there are distances between them, but these distances are allowed to become infinite. So your points will get grouped according to groups of points that are all a finite distance apart from each other and separated by points that are infinite distance apart from each other. So one way to make this like precise is with the following notion called flower curve. So a flower curve is curve C. So let me make sure this definition is slightly complicated, so I better make sure I get it right. With a distinguished point infinity, and n marked points. C1, Cn, and C. And these points are they're allowed to be equal to each other, but not to the infinity point. And this curve can have multiple irreducible components. Each component of C contains infinity, and that's the only. Otherwise, the components don't meet. And there's one additional piece of data. Also, we fix, we are given or something, because part of the data of a flower curve, a non-zero tangent vector. To each component at infinity. Okay, so let me draw a picture. Let's see where the name comes from. It's hidden here. So here's our curve. It has multiple irreducible components, each of which pass through this point, infinity. Now, infinity is just a smooth point of the curve. Each component, I didn't really say this, but each component is isomorphic to P1. So in the neighborhood of this point, it just looks like this. So each component is passing through this infinity, and they meet transversely there like the coordinate axes in Cn. And I'm given some marked points, like so. So, and I'm also given this tangent vector at each curve to infinity. Okay. The role of this tangent vector is sort of to get rid of the automorphisms of each component so that it makes sense to talk about the distances between points on every component. So now, the distances between points on the same component are fine. They're finite distance, and distance between points on different components is infinite. And the way this like works is that, so in the open locus, there's only one component. So this contains Cn mod C as an open subset where we just have one component. And I just have n points on C. And then as these points come together, they go off onto their own components. But it's different. Not as they come together. They're allowed to come together. Sorry, always in these flower curves, not eventually, but for now in these flower curves, I could have two marked points on the top of each other, no problem. And as the flower points go towards this infinity point, then they get onto their own components and become infinitely far from the other points. And so that's the space. And so like the theorem in progress, let's say, this has not been properly written, but is that this is precisely the moduli space of these flower curves. So for this to be precise, you need to set up like exact just moduli functor. Flower curves. With universal curve. Yn plus 1 over Yn.
Yeah. Turn up
the right?
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So when you've got your 2 points on that like leftmost curve.
Yeah.
Let's just start on like a curve with only one component.
Yeah.
And then they come together towards infinity, and then they bubble off onto like another guy.
Yeah.
But then if they like came back down towards infinity, how does it know to bubble off to that third thing instead of like going back to the first? You have like a sequence that like, you know, came out of your first component into your second. And then you would tell me that it had a point at
well,
the component, and it went back down to infinity, it should bubble into a third.
I mean, only if there was still some point left behind on that second component.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should have said that. Every component contains at least one marked point.
So you can only get back to the first guy if you all come back.
If you all go sort of back where you came from, then you get back to where you were. But if one guy stays behind, yeah. So.
Okay.
Like, for example, this guy maybe used to be here, and then he went off on his own component.
Yeah.
And so just to finish the sentence here, like, this precise statement should be that a family of flower curves is the same as a map to Yn, such that that family is pulled back by this map. So this is a family of flower curves, and every other family of flower curves comes by pullback of this family over Yn.
So I was going to ask, is the are all components treated symmetrically, or is there like a principal component?
They're all treated symmetrically. There's no distinguished component. I mean, sometimes there's only one component, but there's no other one. So if we did this, so I didn't maybe say this, but maybe it was obvious. This when n is 3, then you only have 3 of those taus. You have 3 points, and you have 3 pairs of distances between the points.
So
and
you one other question.
Yeah.
So we know that, like, say you have your points z3 and z4, like in that picture.
Yeah.
So if they left my first component together, they could bubble off into a guy by themselves. But if they leave one at a time, do they each go to separate components?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think maybe this example will also help. So, like, imagine n equals 3. So then this y3 is just this a plus b equals c closure thing. And in the open part here, that corresponds to where we just have one component and I have 3 marked points. Along here is where one of them has left onto its own component, and the other two are still here. And that's why 2 of the distances are infinite. So the distance between z1 and z3 is infinite, the distance between z2 and z3. And up here, this special point, which is the same special point everywhere, is, we call it the flower point, and it corresponds to where each of them is on its own component. And hence, all 3 distances are infinite. And there is a sort of beautiful model for this space, for the real locus of Y, so as follows. So let's consider Pn the permutahedron. So this is a polytope made by the convex hull of, let's say it like so, the orbit under Sn of some vector. Let's call it rho, the vector. Maybe rho is, I choose it to be this thing, but just for simplicity. Okay. So this is a polytope inside of the vector space of a1, an, where a1 plus an is 0. So when n is 2, when n is 3, you get this hexagon as your permutahedron. And the permutahedron has faces. Well, let's start with the facets of the permutahedron. It has facets labeled by subsets S inside of 1 up to n. Like, associated to the facet S, the perpendicular vector to the facet, associated subset, I get a vector perpendicular to the facet, which is just the indicator function of S, so something which is 1 on the positions of S and 0 otherwise. So, like, for example, here, the perpendicular guy here would be 1, 0, 0, and the perpendicular guy here would be 1, 1, 0, and so on. A lot of its elements in the dual space of this vector space there. And more generally, faces of the permutahedron are naturally in bijection with ordered set decompositions. So we write one ways of writing 1 up to n as a union of subsets. And ordered, I mean, you keep track of the labeling S1 up to SM. And two bases are parallel. If they correspond to the same, to the underlying unordered set decomposition. If like S1, Sm is the same set as S1 prime, Sm prime. So for example here, this face here corresponds to like the subset 1, or you could say the set decomposition with 1 and 2, 3. And this one corresponds to the subset 2, 3. So you could say the set decomposition 2, 3, and 1. So those are two different ordered set decompositions, but they're the same unordered set decomposition, and they're parallel. These six vertices, they correspond to all possible ordered set decompositions into one element subsets. And of course, there's six of them. And of course, they all give the same one. So all the vertices of this Permian hedron are, of course, parallel. The vertices are always parallel. And now I realize some problem with the boards. Anyway, we're going to move here. Now let's consider the following topological space. I take my permutahedron, and I mod out by all parallel, by identifying all parallel faces of all dimensions. Pn mod delta means identify parallel faces of all dimensions. So for example, here I had these identified opposite sides, and then identify all the vertices. So we get a stratification of this topological space by unordered set decompositions, because that's what labels now are. That's what labels, well, parallel faces up to the parallelism. And well, that's quite convenient because we had it. I didn't say this, but maybe it was clear, that there's a stratification of this space Yn by unordered set decompositions. Namely, you just look at what are the sets of points on each component. That gives you an unordered set decomposition because no component is distinguished. You don't know which order they're on it. Or if you like, you define an equivalence relation on 1 through n by saying two things are equivalent if the distance between them is not infinite. And it's the set decomposition associated to that equivalence relation. So from that, it should be believable, the following theorem, which I think is quite remarkable, that the real points of Yn are homeomorphic to this topological space you get by identifying opposite faces of the permutahedron. I should say that this idea of defining this space like this, it was come from a paper of Bartholdi, Enriquez, Edinghoff, and Reynes. But this theorem is new, even though it seems pretty natural. OK, so now I come to the question of the fundamental group. This is, by the way, not the answer to my original question yet. But it's on the way to the answer to the original question. Now we come to the fundamental group of this space. It has a nice fundamental group, which is called I call it the virtual symmetric group. So the virtual symmetric group, virtual comes from the word virtual in knot theory. Not any other use of the word virtual in math. The virtual symmetric group is the quotient of, you start with two copies of the symmetric group, and you take their free product with each other. So two copies of the symmetric group. They're going to play different roles. This copy of the symmetric group, I'm going to label its elements by permutations. This copy of the symmetric group, I'm going to think of as Coxeter group. So I'm just going to think of the SI in this copy of this metric. Okay. Modulo the relations. that W S I W inverse equals S W of I whenever W of I plus 1 equals W of I plus 1. So what does that look like? It's time to start using some. There was some colored chalk somewhere, but I think it's supposed to be up high somewhere. Where was the chalk? Can someone see it up high somewhere?
It should be on one of those.
One of these things?
No. I mean, isn't that right there?
What?
Like right next to you.
Oh, right here. There it is. Great. Okay. So let's look at what that weird relation means. So one way, the way to think of it is like this. So you have a permutation W. So I'll draw like the diagram of the permutation. So it's permuting some guys around. And maybe it just happens to be the case that there's a pair I plus 1 which are mapped like consecutively afterwards. So W of I equals W of I plus 1 is W of I plus 1. So then this relation is saying that I can put on this SI guy, this special thingy, and move it, slide it through here to the top, or maybe slide it from the top to the bottom or something. So I can imagine elements of this group as being permutations and these special generators, and these generators can just slide along, but only when I have parallel strands like this. Oh, if challenge, if you are bored, think of how to define this for an arbitrary Coxeter group. At first glance, it looks impossible because this is like exactly a weird thing to do in a Coxeter group, to consider the symmetric group acting on the indices, right? But you can define it for arbitrary Coxeter group. And so this group has a natural map to the symmetric group where you take each each copy of the symmetric group to the usual element of the symmetric group, because that relation does hold in the symmetric group. And the kernel is called the pure virtual symmetric group. I call this VSN. So this group is called VSN. And it has a map to SN. And the kernel of that map is called the pure virtual symmetric group. And the theorem is that this pure virtual symmetric group is the fundamental group of that space, either space, because they're the same, all right, like so. And similarly, this virtual symmetric group is this equivariant fundamental group of this space. So this was already proven by this Beer collaboration. But it's actually quite easy to prove it. In fact, surprisingly, it's very easy to give a presentation of this group. OK. And actually, moreover, all higher homotopy groups vanish. OK, so now we're going to get to the space, which is actually the answer. And for that, we just need to correct for the fact that these points are allowed to coincide here. So we're going to correct for them in like the usual Deligne-Mumford way. So a flower cactus curve, let me call it, is a cactus curve, like above. But each component is like in the Deligne-Mumford space, is a nodal curve with mark points. Okay, with distinct mark points. So rather than a picture like this, where I might have some points coinciding, the general thing that I could have is as follows. So I have a curve. So I has maybe multiple components, each like multiple flowers, let's say, components which contain this infinity point, each of which is carrying this tangent vector. And then they themselves could have multiple, could have a components which form a tree, like in the usual Deligne-Mumford space. And then there's some, you know, marked points evenly distributed somewhere. But not evenly, but distributed somewhere, which are distinct. Okay. So there's a space and we construct a space, I call it Fn, which is a moduli space of such curves. Flower cactus curves. So this Fn will map to Yn. So the map just collapses all of these components like so, the ones which are not containing infinity. And the marked points come along for the ride, so then you'll have some multiplicities of the marked points. Okay. So the fibers of this map are products of basically choices of how to do this, which are, so you'll get products of Deligne-Mumford spaces. Where K1, KR record the number of points coming together at different points here. I don't know what to say, that record multiplicities, I guess. Okay. So this multiplicity is like in terms of those tau ij's that I originally defined, this just means i.e. like tau ij equals zero. So groups of points where pairwise all the tau ij's are zero corresponds to a group that's gonna be clumped together here, and so I get a Deligne-Mumford space here. So when I say that there is a space, I mean we constructed a space which has this desired property. Like, and it's like still maybe a harder problem to prove that it really is the parameter space. But the definition of Fn is not maybe as straightforward as you might think. So there's another space which was defined by Mao and Woodward, motivated from symplectic geometry, and it's bigger than the R space. So, there's another space. Which is kind of the one that you would naturally be led to. Mao Woodward space. Qn, which is bigger. I mean, bigger in the sense that it has a map to this Fn, which then maps to it. So when I say you'd naturally be led to this space, this one you can present in the following way. So one way to define m0n plus 1 bar is define it as follows. It's the closure of Cn minus delta in a product of projective spaces, Pn over Cn mod V, where this product ranges over V, ranges over all subspaces and by roots that are irreducible. Irreducible in the sense they can't be written as a direct sum of two subspaces, each of which contains all the roots in them. Anyway, so this is a, not going into too much detail, this is a this DiConcini-Parcesi construction. So you might naively, and like you might guess that we should take the closure of this Cn minus delta, or in both this product and the product that I had from before. But if you do that, this will not give you the right thing. It will give you the bigger space, I think. So this is, anyway, it's certainly not fn. So that's what I mean by it's like not so easy to build fn. Naturally, this is the space you might end up building. Okay, so that's our parameter space. And so now I can state, well, theorem that I guess answers the question. Is that Fn is a parameter space for inhomogeneous Godin algebras. Okay, so the last thing I want to do is tell you about the fundamental group of the real locus. And for that, I'll have to remind you about this cactus group, or I'm telling you about the cactus group. So the cactus group, Pn, has generators, Sij, where 1 is less than I and j are between 1 and n, and relations. So that the generator is square to 1, the generators commute if they're apart from each other. So that means the interval ij intersect the interval kl is empty. So I think of the generators, I think of like 1 up to n, I think of the generators as being sort of associated to an interval ij within 1 up to n. And so this is telling us if we have two disjoint intervals, they'll commute. And now the other relation is when we have one interval contained in another interval. And then the outer interval, the generator for the outer interval conjugates the generator for the inner interval. So this is the situation if KL is contained inside of IJ. And pictorially, we have an outer interval and we have an inner interval. And this funny formula here just means that I've flipped like this KL inside of the outer interval. Okay, so that's the cactus group. And I sort of said it in words, but now I'll say it informally, is that the cactus group is the fundamental group of this real points in the Zeeman-Morphin space. Oh, the equivariant. So now we need to combine this cactus group idea with this virtual symmetric group idea. And then we'll get the fundamental group of our space, of our actual space we're interested in. So we call it the virtual cactus group. So the virtual cactus group is the quotient of the free product of the symmetric group and the cactus group by the relations that WSij equals SW of I, W of J, W. So it's like this kind of thing. Well, I don't know why I put the W there. It's the same as that. So it's like this, and we need some condition. But because Sij is like associated to a whole interval, I'm going to have a stronger condition to that. So it's going to be if W of I plus K equals W of I plus K, for K equals one up to J minus I. So my permutation needs to, my permutation W needs to have a whole group of parallel strands like this, and some other strands. And when I have that, I can take one the Sij generator here and slide it through the permutation. So an element of this virtual cactus group can be thought of as like these generators corresponding to the cactus group, some permutations, and you can slide whenever you have a ladder like so. With the right number of rungs. And then the theorem is that the fundamental group, equivariant fundamental group of this moduli space is isomorphic to the virtual cactus group. So maybe I just close quickly, but what's up with this virtual groups? Why are they appearing? And what does it have to do with this monodromy? The actual answer is pretty simple. So if we, the original cactus group acts on a tensor product of crystals. So let me not explain what crystals are, but just to a first approximation, you just think it's the basis of a representation. So it acts on this tensor product of these. So this is just a finite set that's where each piece consists of a basis of the representation corresponding to this tensor product. And this action is not just by like permuting the tensor factors. So it does something sort of complicated. But of course, there's a symmetric group action that just acts stupid action. Just permute the tensor factors. And if you combine together these two actions, you'll get an action of the virtual cactus group. So the reason why the virtual cactus group is appearing is somehow, or the reason why it's going to act, it acts on this tensor product of crystals where the, not by crystal automorphisms, only the cactus group part acts by crystal automorphisms, and the symmetric group acts in a stupid way, and together they define this virtual cactus group action. Okay, that's all.
The point is, like these moduli spaces appear because the Hamiltonians behave nicely in these limits, right? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Does the
Jupiter? Well, the Hamiltonians like. To be more precise, like this moduli space has an open cover, and on each open set, you can define generators of the algebra, Hamiltonians, which will behave nicely, which will be regular on that open set. Like you can't sort of use the you can't use like the original Hamiltonians because they have the denominators, so you have to define some new generators. Yeah.
So what happens to things like the beta ansatz and the relation to Hilberts in these boundaries?
Ah, that's actually an interesting question. Once we tried to do it, but we kind of gave up. But it should be the case that this definition of Hilberts just extends to these moduli. Like, so rather than thinking about Hilberts on P1, you should think about Hilberts on these nodal curves. Mm-hmm. And we actually, at some point, we're trying to write a paper about that. Like not for this, not for these flower cactus curves, but just the original Zeeman-Hilbert space. So it should be the case that the eigenvectors, eigenvalues, let's say, for these compactified Godin algebras, so Godin algebras depending on points in the boundary here, they'll be given by Hilberts on the corresponding singular curves, corresponding nodal curves. Yeah. But at some point we gave up on writing that. and there actually should be some kind of statement like that also in this case setting. Probably Lenya knows what it would be, but I don't know off the top of my head. What you could say about Hilberts related to eigenvalues for these inhomogeneous Godin algebras. But there should be a statement as well. Like I won't even try.
Yeah, I think from the physics picture, you know, these various papers of Field Dowding really like to derive the relationship between overs and eigenvalues of the Godin model using S duality. Like, I think that number genius one fits in there too, so
Great. But did they consider this kind of compactification that did? Does it show up naturally in their work?
I mean, there's some, you know, points where you put line defects and you can imagine them coming together, but they certainly don't consider anything like this. I have another question. So people also like to study the XXX model, which is a deformation of the Godin model, and it has kind of worse singularities.
Is that what called trigonometric Godin algebras, I think?
It's different. So the Godin algebra involves the classical one matrix. And you use the quantum one matrix instead.
I'm sure my co-authors can answer that question, but I don't know. I mean, is that related to this beta subalgebras and Yangians?
Exactly.
So I can say a couple words about that. So they proved. There's a little bit of parallel story there. So if you take, there's a map. You can define a map from phi reg, so the regular part of a maximal torus, to this beta. So two commutative subalgebras. In the Yangian. And there's a space which it's actually easier to, it's an analog. So there's two spaces. There's the analog of, so this is like, I'll just write analog for my talk. This is the analog of Cn minus delta mod C. The analog of Yn would be the toric variety associated to the permutahedron, or the closure of T inside the wonderful compactification, has a number of different descriptions. And then the analog of Fn, which is something which maps to this, is what you get. It's a space defined by DiConcini and Gaifi. So you take this, it's easier to define than Fn because this space is, you just take this, well, I don't know if it's easier, but they did it anyway. So it was already done on like Fn as far as I know. So you take the root hyperplane arrangement here and you blow up there's an arrangement of subtori here corresponding to the root hyperplanes. And you do some blow-up construction on that arrangement of subtori, and you get this space here. So it's a kind of, like in type A, this is a multiplicative version of this space. And they proved, actually, I think it's not written yet, or they're working on it, that this map here, which associates to C, the beta algebra associated to C, this extends to a map like so. And in a similar way, you can study the monodromy here. The fundamental group of this space, or the real, so you, this space is a, you take the compact real form of this space. That's the analog of what we're doing here, would be to take the, well, okay, you let's take the compact real form of the torus, this direction, and then this fundamental group it's a kind of affine cactus group. Which is related to this virtual cactus group I defined here. So there is a story, a kind of parallel story there. Yeah, and then in type A, in type A, there's a degeneration of these algebras to those trigonometric, to those inhomogeneous Godin algebras, which you mentioned, and that can be seen geometrically by a degeneration of this space to this one. And like this space is actually just, in type A, is also just M0n plus 2. So happens to be M0, M plus 2. And then this corresponds to degeneration here, where you have two distinguished points. So it has more marked points, one more marked point. So you have ordinary Lie-Mumford space, but with two of the marked points sort of distinguished. And when these two distinguished marked points come together, they become this infinity point here, and they and then maybe when they come together, they can possibly squeeze together a bunch of components like this, and you get this picture. Anyway, there's a degeneration like so, which relates to that.
Are there any more questions? Let's thank the speaker again.
I have a question.
Yeah? Who is that?
could you give me an example about the flower curve in physics?
What about a flower?
An example of the flower curve in physics. If you don't know an example, I'm just saying no.
Maybe Kevin can.
Well, I mean, it's what you said. It's like you can get some limit of go down Hamiltonians and. The point in the flower curve is specifies a possible limit. Is that right?
Yeah. Was that okay, his answer? The points of the...
Okay, thank you.
Flower points correspond to limits of these trigonometric Godin Hamiltonians.
Okay, thank you.
But for example, maybe as an example, since you asked for an example, suppose we take this maximal flower point, which I mentioned. So there's a special point in this, unlike in the Lie-Mumford space, is sort of a unique special point where you have a flower with one marked point at each petal. So that corresponds to a special limit of these Godin algebras. And what it is the following algebra. You take the, there's an algebra called the shift of argument algebra. I don't know if people call it that. Everyone calls it that, but that's what I call it, following Lenya, shift of argument algebra. So it's a subalgebra. It depends on this parameter chi, and it just lives in one copy of UG. And corresponding to this flower point is just put this a chi in every tensor factor, and then maybe add the diagonal copy of the UH, something like that. So that's the subalgebra corresponding to this maximal flower point.
So they're all kind of decoupled, maybe.
Yeah.
Great.